I'm Dustin Zahn, and this is Trainwrecks. I am raw dogging it today on the intro. I have absolutely no notes. Actually, that's kind of a common occurrence, but today is no different, I guess. But let's just get right into it. Our guest for the day is Radio Slave. He's back on the show. He was on, I don't know how many years ago. It was on the first run, so about 8-9 years ago. We went through it all with him, so if you like this episode and you want to know more about him, check that one out. That's a little bit more of a history lesson. Quick catch-up if you don't know who he is. He's a dude that he's really connected to the house and techno world. He's made, I think, somewhere around 7,034 remixes, give or take a couple. Countless EPs. He's got a handful of albums under his belt under various aliases such as his own. There's Wrecked, there's Quiet Village, Matom, and Redhead or Red Machine or something like that. There's so many that I can't remember even. Anyway, he's known for making really long tracks that kind of just keep evolving and sucking you in, and in my opinion, they don't get old, you know. I think they're, I've got so many of his tracks. I've been on his label. I've done, well, Strangers to Stability came out on there. We kind of met back in Minneapolis and gave him those tracks, and that was history. After that, I did a couple singles on the RSPX label, and then and even an album. So yeah, we had a little history. We wrote a record together as Radio's On. That's more of a house thing that... I guess it's an ode to New York. One side's more of a Danny Tenaglia tribute, and the other is DJ Duke, powerhouse kind of music stuff. So if you're curious about that and you haven't heard that record, it's still out there. Go check it out. I think actually the wax is long gone, but you can find it on all the Spotify, Beatport, all that kind of shit. Aside from that, he just released a new album. Well, not just released, but his most recent release. It's called Vente. It's 20 years of Radio Slave. It basically is a celebration of everything that his profiles encompassed. It ranges from down tempo to disco to house, and you know, even caps it off with kind of the hypnotic Radio Slave techno that a lot of us have come to know. That's on records as well, so be sure to check that out. And he also released a Quiet Village album. I don't know the name of it at all or the label because I'm a bad person, but Google it. I'm sure you'll find it. It's really cool stuff. If you like soundtracky, built up sort of vibe that, I don't know, it's really cool. It's hard to explain. I think you'll enjoy it if you like some low-key shit. Aside from that, I've been busy, but not as busy as I could be. I've been trying to soak in the last few days of summer. It's been pretty nice. That also means I really don't have a whole lot to promote on my end. I will be back in New York first weekend of October. I'm coming back for Merge. That's a really cool party that I played the first one that they started. And I think they're on their third or fourth year now. So I'm looking forward to getting back and seeing how things are going. They always have killer lineups. And, a lot of the resident DJs are old friends and new friends, so it's cool to get back together and see what happens. If you're curious about that, I don't know what the deal is with tickets, but search Merge New York, go on my Instagram. You'll see the really badass flyer. And then, hope to see you out. Enjoy the show. Hey, man, welcome back to the show.
It's good to be back.
Yeah. Thanks, Dustin. Thanks for coming over. It's right at the end of summer, but it's been kind of sweltering, so.
Yeah.
Someone posted a flyer the other day of your first time in Minneapolis, which is where I met you.
Yeah, that was a long time ago.
Did you see that post? I think maybe it was Hester or somebody. 2007, wow. October.
Yeah.
So we've known each other almost 20 years.
That's crazy.
Yeah. I mean, and then I was just starting to think about it, and then I was like, Grindhouse, I guess that came out about 16 years ago.
That was 2008.
I moved here in 2011, I think, and you were just... You were still here. Moved to Croatia recently, right?
Yeah, so basically I moved with the family in September 2022, so it's almost 2 years ago, and now living on the island of Hvar, which is 1 hour on a boat from Split, and it's kind of like it's a completely different vibe to here, which I've obviously coming back on the train on Thursday evening, arriving in Berlin was quite an experience.
Yeah. Just because of the...
it was just everything from the smells, you know, everything, just how busy the city is. I mean, Berlin seems to be super busy and just full of people. It's a completely, it's a different city to the one that I moved to in 2007.
Absolutely. I mean, my first time here was 2001 or two. It was kind of coming back just about every year after that, even if just for one tour or something, but obviously I ended up living here. Anyway, it was like dead. You could walk for 20 minutes at night and not run into anybody.
Yeah.
And now, like, right out here on the street, it's so goddamn loud every night till like 4 a.m.
Right.
It's just drunk, crazy people.
Yeah.
And this used to be a quiet neighborhood, you know? So it's changing a lot. But what's daily life like for you out there now?
It's a good question. I mean, you know, I've got the family, kids, it's pretty much the same as here. I don't have a proper studio set up at the moment, but, you know, I'm working off a computer, and which is fine. And actually, I'm enjoying that. I'm sure we can talk more about that. And then, my daily life is basically now running the label. And that's actually something that I'm really enjoying, and something that maybe I should have addressed years ago and spent more time on. And it's quite a lot of work. It's really rewarding, and I'm enjoying it. Even though it's difficult, I'm enjoying the whole process.
Nice. And I got a question. What happened to all the records that you had in Berlin?
So all of my records, pretty much everything, my records, all the art, the books, everything's still here. So we decided pretty quickly in the summer of 2022 to move, and with that. I went to Asia to do a tour, even though Japan was still kind of in lockdown. I had to get a special visa. There were no tourists. It was amazing. There was no foreigners there. And then I spent the whole month of August touring, and my wife literally just went in a car with her brother, with the kids to Croatia. So I've been living sort of out of a backpack or you know, a small amount of items, which is good. But yeah, all the records are still here. And I'm guessing that I'm probably going to get rid of them. I think all of my dreams of having this, you know, like audiophile set up and a study, you know, sitting back in a chair like you're sitting and, you know, mm-hmm. enjoying music. I just think that's kind of dream, or that's just not where I'm at.
It sailed, huh?
Yeah. And yeah. I mean, for me, my relaxation time, if I want my time, then I put headphones on and I make music. That's it. Mm-hmm. That's what I'm into. You know, or I'll just go for a walk or go for a swim.
Yeah. I mean, I get it. Like just the other day I went and bought a few new records and I'm walking back. I'm like, what the fuck am I doing? Like, yeah. I know like this dream that you were talking about, yeah. I have it too, where you're like, well, someday if people come over for dinner, they can just pick out any record and it'll be fucking slapper. It's not that boat sailed, man. Yeah. It's over.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sold for pretty much everyone I know, and I don't know. I mean, you know, I've sort of we all get drawn into these conversations online about vinyl versus digital and et cetera, et cetera. And I mean, I just think that argument is now just a joke, you know. And I think people just need to come to terms with the fact that, you know, the gramophone was invented in 1898 or whatever it was. I mean, it's hundreds of years. Yeah. Old this tech and it's great. I mean, vinyl is great. It's fun. It's a physical format like books, but actually, you know, I think that we can live without them, especially when it comes to new music. So, and some things work, some things don't. Joel Martin and I've just released our first Quiet Village record in 17 years. And we've actually repressed it, so we sold 1,000 copies, which is amazing. But nice. That's to a completely different audience. It's not DJs. So, and I'm sure you're the same. I know very few DJs that play our kind of music, like contemporary club music.
Yeah.
That will play vinyl, because a lot of it's just not released, you know.
Yeah.
So it's hard, you know, it's hard. Even if you wanted to do a vinyl only set of contemporary music, that'd be hard.
It is, for sure. I mean, if I'm being honest, most of the stuff I would buy these days is vinyl only, just because it's vinyl only. Like, otherwise I'll just fucking go online. I don't care. But it also brings up another question. Like, I understand why people still get the allure of vinyl only stuff, but it is like sort of inadvertently already become a classist thing too. Like, I feel like only like rich white guys can afford vinyl. You know what I mean? Like,
100%. I mean, I think it can be seen as being elitist, and obviously it's very expensive. And so, you know, those days of, I think, especially in the States, and you'll know this, I mean, buying a domestic release back in the 90s, it was so cheap.
Yeah. I bought them just because they were cheap.
Yeah.
I wanted the European records.
But, you know, that's the thing, they were cheap. Buying records when I was younger was cheaper. So you could buy more. And but now, you know, going into Hard Wax and seeing a Lies record for 30 euros, when you know that you can buy the same release on Bandcamp, it just doesn't make sense. And then I look at the label like Ron Morelli's Lies, and I just think, you know, what's the point? You know, it's kind of like it's not forward thinking in a sense. It's very, you know, it's looking back. It's mostly, it's rehashing old music.
Yeah, so it's just make drum machines sense. Through a rat pedal. Yeah. Like, I like some of those records,
yeah, me
but
too.
It's kind of like, how many of them do you need? You know?
Yeah.
Like, I love old Chicago Jack tracks, all that kind of stuff. Like, it's highly influential for me. But so many DJs these days that aren't playing like the wind up big room bullshit, they're trying to play that sort of stuff, which I like. But I'm like, how many times can you hear this like 707 clap loop over and over again? I'm like, I love the old days and I have nostalgia, but I want like new sounding house shit that blows my mind as much as that stuff. No, I don't get excited by Jack tracks anymore. But yeah, so the records are still here. Is there anything you miss about Berlin?
That's a good question. Actually, maybe my friends, seeing people, but I mean, you know, we're so connected by other means, you know, so.
Yeah.
And I speak to you know, guys like, friends like Spencer all the time, and yeah, so there's nothing I really miss about the city, no.
Yeah, I get it. I mean, like, Berlin and I are in a toxic relationship. There's days where I absolutely love this city, and then there's days where I'll just complain nonstop. I probably complain to you. I enjoy complaining about Berlin, but it's also, there's things about it that are great. Like, it still has that vibe that, you know, when you first get off the plane, you're like, dude, this place is cool, except for it wears off if you live here. And the only way to really tap into that is to, like, get pretty drunk. And how many times can you do that these days, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's become more and more trashy, but not in a good way. I think it had this when I first started coming here in the early 2000s. It was definitely, I used to always say, it was the sort of last real place of bohemia in Europe.
You know,
and everything felt so free and sort of, you know, in this, like, with clubs like Bar 25 and everything, and also. Musically, it was more diverse back then.
Absolutely.
Everyone talks about diversity now, but musically, it was way more diverse in the 2000s and probably even in the 90s. And with clubs like, events like Broken Hearts Club, and, you know, there was just so much. It seemed more vibrant, you know, with this. There was the disco, not disco scene, this punk funk scene. You had like Peaches, Electro Clash. And then, of course, the punk scene here, and, you know, there would just seem to be so much going on. And I'm sure it may be the same in some respect, but yeah, it doesn't seem like that from the outside, you know?
I agree. I mean, it seems like there are people that are into different shit these days, but it felt like back then there was real movements behind this stuff.
Yeah.
Like, at any given time, you had Justice happening at the same time as Minus, at the same time as, like, kind of Carl Craig's revival, at the same time as, you name it. There were so many things. And now when you think about music, all everybody talks about is either EDM, the TikTok shit, or purist stuff. It's been like put into three boxes and not much room for anything in between.
Yeah, I mean, in that respect, I think Berlin, the music's, again, it's, you can see this, it's way more visual. You know, you can see that with the kids walking around Berlin with the guys with the crop tops and the baggy, they look like these Midwest ravers from, yeah. You know, there's that look. And the other thing is as well, is that when I first started coming to Berlin, there were a lot of labels here and there's hardly any labels left in Berlin. And, you know, I wrote a song about Berlin on my album, which is called 30 to 36, which was the old postcode for Kreuzberg, and trying to find a remixer I was actually planning to release it on another label. And it's just that there aren't so many labels left or, you know, in the city that really represent the city as well, I think.
Totally. I was talking to somebody last night over drinks and we're, you know, in this context, it was really directly about techno and maybe more like the rolling sort of dark pure shit that I do or whatever. But we're like, there really isn't anything left for labels. Being on a particular label won't really sell. It won't make the record sell any more or less, in my opinion. Yeah. Like if I give you a record today or if I give it to Blueprint or Token or something, it's pretty much going to do the same. Or if I put it on my own label. Yeah. However, doing it on a bigger or credible label does connect you to a certain tribe or like quality. Yeah. You know what I mean? So there is that aspect. But I don't really think that's really what's going to make or break a person these days.
No.
You know?
No.
And you see people that, like, you hear, like, oh, is that person still around? And it turns out they're playing 8 times a month. When's the last time anybody spoke about their records? It's just about making it work for you.
I think, I was thinking about this a lot, is that a lot of the DJ-led labels, I mean, it's the other thing with, you know, obviously my position, and I'm touring less, and I'm at home, and I'm running, like, now it's 3 labels, or actually 4, and... you know, it takes time, you know. So a lot of these labels that popped up in the 2000s, these DJ owned labels, they've just disappeared as well. Yeah. You know? Either the DJs have changed their direction musically, or, you know, they're not playing, or they've just they've fallen out of love with whatever they're doing. But, you know, so it's
totally, or they really run it like a business. It's a numbers thing. And, you know. So there's a lot of difference to that, but I could say, like, over the years, like, I mean, it's no secret, obviously, like, you're a prolific producer and you've crossed so many genres over your career. I think, well, when I first met you, you were like real deep into what I think, in my opinion, really blew up the Radio Slave sound, like the hypnotic, minimalistic techno shit, Peace Division remixes and all that. But then when I moved to Berlin around 2011, at that point, you seem to be like pretty much back in a house phase for a minute.
Yeah.
You were doing like the Strictly Rhythm mix and all that. And, but then, you know, a few years later, you were back to making records like Don't Stop, No Sleep. So like, how do you, and in that, actually, I guess now with the album Venti, it just feels like maybe you're in a little bit more of a housey mode again.
I mean, I think I made the Venti album during the pandemic, a lot of the tracks were, so it was a lot of experimentation into like pop with tracks like, or songs like Amnesia. And I guess it was like the Venti project is like a patchwork of a lot of different influences. And it was also a kind of a lot of it was about the process as well of making these tracks or making these songs. And now that's led me to a point where I'm actually looking back at like 2007.
Mm-hmm.
Where I was doing these like remixes for like Tom Gandy, Cage Baby, or like for Moxie, or for like Peace Division, and I'm feeling now more into this vibe, this kind of futuristic hypnotic stuff, and but rather than a remix or put this sound on remixes, I'm now going to try and replicate that, but with songs.
Yeah,
and because if I also look at what happened, a lot of the music that I made back then, like the Trent Moller remix, became like a blueprint in a way for like Tales of Us and also for Kind of Music. It's kind of, it's obviously they've watered it down, but a lot, especially with Kind of Music, if I listen to some of their remixes or tracks, it's kind of pretty similar.
Totally. It's just kind of the 10-minute drum loop with the acapella.
Yeah,
it or
it's
whatever.
Just softer and, you know, sort of more maybe conservative, but that approach, and even with Tales of Us, I know they play the Trent Muller remix a lot, or they used to, and obviously, their sounds become way more plastic and poppy and, you know, trancey.
Yeah.
But I like that period that you talked about, and this kind of futuristic, forward-thinking sound. And, you know, for me, you know, electronic music should be that. And sometimes, I don't know, during my career, of course, I've looked back, I've got into these, like, other things. But I think at the moment, I'm definitely feeling like, I mean, I'm almost thinking of doing an album called, like, 2008, you know, something like that. You know, because I think that there was a period where that it was really quite really interesting musically, you know.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I mean, the aughts, which we could go into a lot in a minute if you want, like there was a lot of really incredible music and a lot of really bad music.
Yeah.
And then afterwards, it kind of just seemed to be like it skewed more towards bad music as the years went on.
Yeah, I mean, I think I might have even written to you about this in a text, but I mean, I think that the noughties are really overlooked, you know, as a decade. And for me, it was one of the best, you know, and with everything from guys like Matthew Johnson with Wagon Repair and all the minimal stuff, it was an amazing decade of music.
I agree. I mean, like there was a point where songs had a structure or a premise, and I don't know if they are intentionally doing it. It just happened. Like they would be like, I'm going to go big for this, whether it's like an 8-minute long Audion track and there would be an actual hook.
Yeah.
And of course there was a lot of like breakdown shit and people got tired of breakdowns, understandably, which now there's almost no breakdowns, it seems like, but unless it's like the big room house snare roll shit. But especially now in techno, it's just like all tools. There's no people that are like, right, I'm going to take something. They're afraid of being polarizing, whether it's a vocal or a hook or something.
Yeah.
You know, it's like we better just keep it drummed down and tooly. And it's like, which I released on my label, I play, but I'm like, okay, that's like the safest thing you can do.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I mean, I think back in the 2000s, there were a lot of the records had big ideas and they were like, you know, you mentioned Audion, Mouth to Mouth, you know, or even like Chicken Lips, all this stuff. It was quite bold, like, but in design, you know, it was kind of like, this is going to be different. We're going to do something completely different, you know? Tracks had personality. And I think as well, you know, especially if, you know, mentioning kind of music again, which, you know, obviously they're becoming like the biggest DJs in the world. And the music, some of it's, I kind of like, but it's incredibly conservative. And it's kind of like fitting to this, you know, finally all the VIP clubs are happy because there's the music that they can play rather than having like Martin Garrix blasting out EDM. Suddenly they have this music that's really easygoing that can be played at.
It's just a very easily digestible version of, I guess things that we were kind of into, old tribal house or whatever. Yeah. And, you know, a little bit more, just gentrified, I guess.
Yeah, and that's why I can understand sometimes, like, I've got friends, or, you know, I know people that are into this fast techno, and I can understand the movement in a way, because even though it's very old, and actually my ex-wife took me to an Australian trance rave at the Astoria in Tottenham Court Road in, I think it was 1998. And I just sat there. I was like, just horrified by it.
I bet. Yeah.
And just, you know, everyone was wearing the Cyberdog stuff. So it's pretty similar. So now I can understand why maybe the younger audience are wearing this uniform, because they see it as being rebellious. You know, it's like the new punk sort of thing. Even though it's to us, maybe it might look old, it's to them, it's something brand new.
It's new to them. And also, like, everybody wants to fit in. Like, that's actually, I want to go back to this progression musical thing. But now that we brought up fashion, I was thinking about it. It's like people love to complain about fashion and the music thing, like dance club shit. Fashion was always part of this. It just, you didn't have to spend 600 euros on a shirt to like fit in. But, you know, everybody had like the baggy pants and there was always raver fashion. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, there was the raver fashion. But I think, you know, when I was young, going out, it was definitely like there wasn't a uniform per se. And like, you know, there were trends. But it's completely different to now, where you've got all these DJs wearing this 44 shirt and all this kind of stuff. And it's, I'm just not into that sort of like this clone, cloning, you know, but
Well, I mean, I came into this because it was counterculture music. And when you start talking about like heavy branding and like putting every logo on your shit so everybody knows how much you spent, I'm like, that kind of goes completely against what the culture started off on, right? You know, like, hey, I like nice shit.
Yeah.
I'm wearing like Cotopaxi pants right now and they're bright and ridiculous. So it's not like I'm against having fun, but it shouldn't be like broadcasted or something, you know?
Yeah, no, for sure. I mean, and you brought up the word, well, the, you know, counterculture. I think there's very little left of that in electronic music. You know, that's completely disappeared, and it's disappeared in most aspects of culture, you know, whether it's the arts or, you know, anything. So that's difficult.
Yeah. I mean, I would actually say, though, I feel like in a way I'm glad that finally counterculture has come back. Well, I'm looking at it definitely from more of an American perspective, but it feels like in the aughts, the public enemy number one was the hipster until it was time to eat, you know, and it was cool. But aside from that, like anything hipster kind of got assimilated into culture and like everything's just cool now, but nobody was really fighting back on anything. And now with counterculture, you're looking more at like... maybe your mumble rap kids with the shit on their faces, or you have like the trans culture, LGBTQT, like a lot of these type of things. Yeah. Or, you know, people who they just want to push back on something. It could be politics or whatever, you know, Antifa, you hear about all that. And it's like, I usually subscribe to a lot of that anyway, but it's like, even the stuff that I think is ridiculous, I roll my eyeballs on. I'm like, actually, this is a good thing. Like, counterculture is supposed to at some point be like, push your buttons or be a little offensive, because that's how there's progress.
For sure.
Now, of course, they go too far. Yeah. That's what you have to do. You got to find the limitations.
Yeah. No, for sure.
Before I went off on that tangent, we were talking about maneuvers. Like, how do you decide, like, how do you usually find out, like, okay, I feel like I'm in house mode now? Is it like to pivot against the industry or?
I've made a conscious decision during the pandemic to sort of, I've always been into house. I've always been a house head. That's where I sort of like, that was, I mean,
primarily,
that was the first clubs I went to, house clubs in London, and then Ministry of Sound, Larry Levan, Tony Humphries, they were all the DJs we were listening to. And, a lot of my friends actually went to Lost, and I remember going to Lost a couple of times, and it just wasn't my thing. It was like, this was like 94, and it was pretty hard in the main room.
Really?
It was relentless, and it was just mostly guys. And of course, you know, they had some amazing parties, but I was always more leaning towards the more fun sort of house side of club culture. So, I mean, I don't know. I love techno as well. I love all kinds of music. But I kind of like, I don't know, I don't think any of us could have really seen what would become of techno. I think it was, to me, it's been really abused. And, I just don't feel comfortable playing really fast. You know, I'm okay going up to like 1/3-6. And of course, we release a lot of records at that tempo on RSPX, but I really like playing, like guys like, or producers like Uncertain. I love playing his tracks slower, you know, same with Mark as well, and with Mark Broomen. And anything beyond that, I don't know. I get it. I understand it, but it's never been my thing. And I don't know. I mean, for me, I'm still totally into the more kind of Detroit side, but maybe this it's a little bit trad in a way, but I like the musical side of techno, which I'm not hearing as much, you know. So and I don't even know if people want to hear it. You know, that's the thing. So it's
I'm not convinced that people actually like music. I think they hate silence, is what it is. Yeah. You know, like a lot of times these days when you listen to techno, they might listen to the TikTok edit thing and be like, this is ridiculous. Isn't it like ironic listening?
Yeah.
Or they just really, that's the hit that they know from the radio. Yeah. So they have that connection. Or you have the pure stuff like where I said, like, I love it. I play it. But there's not a lot of it that has personality.
No.
So like, I know you have a very rich background as a music listener, as do I. We could talk about deep on other genres for hours. And most people these days cannot.
Yeah.
You know, they don't anybody past Drake or Ye or something. That's fine. Not everybody has to be a music snob.
No.
But I think that's part of the reason.
No, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's I think it's with all of the noise that's out there, it's obviously, it's just become harder and harder to shout about the good stuff. And obviously that's something that, you know, that's why I'm still running the label and still pushing the music through records. And, you know, that's why I'm still doing it.
Absolutely. I get it. And I wrote a bunch of different questions lately, and there's a couple that kind of resonate with where we're going right now. I was thinking about the quote, like, they don't make them like they used to, right, which I guess is definitely something you say as you get older and whatnot. But I find it fascinating because it really seems true. I'll finally check out a band that I just never did my whole life. And you're like, why didn't I listen to them?
Yeah.
And that album from 83 is incredible. It's better than anything I heard in 2023.
Yeah.
Would you agree? I mean, like, there was just something about that.
Well, that whole discussion, I mean, obviously, you know, back then, studios or labels had money, mm-hmm, and so they would invest a lot of money into the recording process. I mean, if you listen to these podcasts, you know, like with Francois Kevorkian or David Morales talking about the whole process of doing a remix in the early 90s and how much money they'd actually spend. Yeah. I mean, they would spend like tens of thousands of
just on tape.
But, you know, getting the studio, working on the desk, you know, getting people, getting assistant engineers, getting, you know, and especially if you go back even further with, you know, I'm obsessed with 80s pop and guys like Trevor Horn. And, you know, when you listen to things like Grace Jones, Slave to the Rhythm, and it doesn't really get much better than that. I mean, it's like, that's like a masterpiece, you know, so sonically, and it's really just, it's so rich and it's arty, it's abstract, but it's pop. And, if you fast forward to now, I mean, there are artists, there are people who invest a lot of their own money, their own time into their craft, but they don't get heard. And then this is the thing, and that's a shame.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, there's with the technology becoming easier to use, there's way more people making music. So again, it's like, you know, finding the good shit is becoming harder and harder.
Yeah. I mean, I think everybody deserves a chance at making music and finding their zen moment at the very least. Doesn't mean I think everybody needs to be re-released, you know, but everybody else would disagree. They're like, I stand a chance.
But then, right, you know, that's, I mean, I mean, that's what record labels were there for, you know. And, you know, to go through, sift through all the music and find the best of the best, you know. So
during the pandemic, like lockdown time, I was buying a lot of shit on Bandcamp. I figured it was like my one way I could kind of contribute and keep things moving. And like, I had free time, so I'd find a lot of cool shit on Bandcamp from nobody producers.
Yeah.
And flip them a few bucks or whatever. And then I go to put this on the CDJs, and then you realize like, this all actually sounds like total shit. Like, not the tracks of it, but like, they had no A&R to sit there and be like, this kick drum's too loud, or this hi-hat needs to come up. There's no mastering. Yeah. It's just direct to consumer in the worst way possible.
I mean, I think there's 100,000 releases per week that come out. So it's a lot of music. And this is the thing, I mean, even though, you know, some artists are streaming incredibly well, you know, it's the streaming numbers are going down for most people because there's just so much content, and also people just aren't listening to it. I mean, I think that there's a little bit of a bubble that's burst around electronic music, and we're seeing that as well in the live sector with, you know, less people attending festivals and everything.
Yeah, they're all flopping.
Yeah, and also people aren't buying the music. You know, people are going to these events. I mean, I'm sure we all know people who say, "Oh, I love your music," and they don't buy any of it.
They don't support you. Have no idea what you do.
Yeah, yeah. Or they don't support it. You know, so then they get everything for free. So
totally. I mean, I did a lot of writing for today's episode. I wrote it somewhere and I can't find it, but I know what I wanted to bring up too. It's like Spotify. You mentioned how the numbers are going down and stuff. I think it's kind of hilarious how so many producers and labels are absolutely convinced that Spotify is what's ruining their career or right. their numbers at least. And I'm like, listen, your music's not fit for Spotify. And the fact that 3,000 people streamed it isn't what's costing you money. Like, there's piracy is still rampant. Yeah, nobody talks about it.
Yeah.
Nobody pays for music.
Yeah, I think that there's the this is one of the things that obviously running a label, as you know, there's the expectations of the artist and also the limitations of the label and artist. And essentially, if people aren't into it, they're not going to listen to it.
Yeah.
So, and I think people's, you know, there's a lot of people are driven by ego and they expect, why aren't they streaming it? Why aren't they listening to it? It's just because maybe it's just not good enough. You know, yeah. So and there's billions of other music to listen to. So,
yeah, I mean, like, it really does help when you have things like Spotify or Beatport or whatever site where they effectively put it up on the wall, like yeah. a featured release, getting a release radar. All that stuff is beneficial or necessary, yeah. but like that was never really their job. Their job was to just make it available.
Yeah. But yeah, also, we got to remember to people listening or anyone, but that. Beatport only services DJs.
Yeah.
Like no one, if you speak to anyone out who's not a DJ or not really into electronic music, they've probably never heard of Beatport, you know? So, and of course for music fans, you have Bandcamp or Spotify. So, most people are gravitating towards Spotify, I guess, you know? And so, and that is becoming incredibly hard to, promote, music, you know?
Big time. I guess we can just jump into it. Like a lot of this you have the experience with because for those who don't know, you're running Records, which is like, I guess, the main label.
Yeah.
What are the other three sub-labels, just so people are aware?
So at the moment we have Records and then RSPX, which is a techno label. And actually, yeah, then I'm also co-running the Quiet Village label, which we've just set up. And then we're launching a new... Actually, we're relaunching Wrecked, which you were part of.
Okay, yeah.
But that's going to be a house subsidiary to promote young artists, give them a foot in the door. And then, I'm just being sent so much music that we need to find another outlet. And then I'm actually also running the My Medicine label for Lady Taz. Okay. So this is another project that I'm involved in. So I'm doing all of the A&R for the label, the creative direction, and that's been really fun because it's something completely different. It's free, and she does labels, she does events, and so, yeah, that's fun.
Nice. The thing that I liked about working with you and Records in general for quite a long time now is that it's actually run like a real label and not a lemonade stand.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like so many labels these days have no structure, infrastructure whatsoever.
I mean, I'm very lucky to know Leon Oakey. I mean, he's become a really good friend, one of my best friends, and he's the label manager for Records, and he was the label manager for Classic with Luke Solomon and Derek Carter. He's been involved in music for a long time. He was also label manager at Amato, mm-hmm. the distribution company. And, you know, he looks, not only does he look after Records, but he looks after Crosstown Rebels and Hot Creations and probably like nine more labels. And so what's great is he's got a very good or very wide broad understanding of the industry as a whole. So, you know, and also of the numbers and, as I've said, sort of the expectations, limitations, you know, what can work, what can't work. Because, you know, I mean, with Records, you know, to release an album from Monty, which is amazing, which, you know, has been, you know, I get incredible emails from like Francois Kevorkian about this album, you know, loads of people love it, but it hasn't done amazingly, you know, because it's very niche.
Mm-hmm.
So to do things like that, then we will release maybe an EP from, say, Cassim, which is more a little bit more commercial, something that I'd still play, but it's
totally,
you know, it's
got to have some bigger records and some smaller ones.
Yeah, yeah. And if you're into podcasts like Dustin's, then I just listened to a really interesting one with Simon Dunmore. I think it's on House Culture.
Okay.
On Spotify. And, you know, he talks about that with Defected, you know, and if you look at a label like that, so it's way more commercial than Records, but that's how they survived, you know.
Totally.
So, and I think a lot of labels just, the reason why they're not around is because they can't adapt like that, you know, or mm-hmm. they don't maybe have a musical spectrum as wide as, say, Wreckage, where we can work with like Joe Clausel and then work with Robert Hood, then work with you or work, you know, mm-hmm. so it's, and it all kind of fits, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that's the other part of it is like, you have a lot of people who I don't think they have a single clue on how to run a label, and not yeah. just trying to be mean, but like legitimately, like they don't know how to get the record from A to B, how to like actually write it down in a calendar. Like when yeah. you come to me and you say, Dustin, we're doing an EP on Records. We need it by this date because it's being cut on this date.
Yeah.
And then it's releasing in 8 weeks or something. Yeah. And you're like, shit, okay, this is an actual machine.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not like we'll get around to it like so many labels yeah. do. And also like the accounting is dead on, which is great, you know, because so many labels, I get it, you can't afford to have an accounting office if you're a smaller label, but they don't even consider in the fact that it could flop or it could be yeah. make a lot of money. Either way, you got to kind of have a plan, you know?
Yeah, but so, and also, I mean, we are as transparent as we can be. And yeah, I mean, you have to be, because I mean, we're working with a lot of friends like you, and it has to be like that. I mean, I've worked with so many labels and the deals have been bad. And then the accounting's been bad, or they just don't account to you, mm-hmm. stuff like this. You know, they ignore you. And I mean, it's just no way to treat people in general, you know.
I was talking to somebody last night, and she said that, you know, I did this record on this label. It sold out. Not a huge amount, but it sold out. And then, so she's like, okay, is there any money around to collect? You know, like just yeah. seeing what's up, asking for any sort of statement, and they're just basically trashing this chick, like,
wow.
Don't be annoying about it, we'll take care of it later, yeah, those kind of yeah. things. And I'm like, I guess anybody that's listening right now, you should always have the ability to reach out and say, hey, what's going on?
Yeah, for sure.
Not, don't say, like, give me my money, because there just might not be any, yeah. but you have the right to have a look.
Yeah, yeah, you know? For sure.
But good luck getting paid, that's a whole other podcast. aside from obvious pitfalls, like trying to sell records or get streams or just get noticed, what are some other pitfalls or obstacles for records on a day-to-day?
I think it's just, I mean, I wouldn't say there's any, it's a good question. I mean, we're constantly adapting and, you know, obviously as the market shifts, I don't know. I mean, it's the same as it's ever been. I mean, it can become problematic. We're trying to obviously not work with the troublemakers. We had some troublemakers in the past, some quite heavy hitting troublemakers.
Yeah.
So we're trying to keep it really the family really close, and I'm trying to, you know, I'm trying to work with nice people and, but, you know, it's difficult. You know, if we work with a young artist, I mean, these days, you know, there's management companies, they jump in, they swoop in straight away. And then, of course, they just think of records as a sidestep, yeah. you know. And so that's become an issue. And we've seen that in the last few years. So we've had to sort of make some bold decisions whether we work with people or not. Because we can see it coming from the get-go, you know.
For sure. I mean, there's no school on this stuff, so it's not surprising when they do come with their management team and yeah. they start making all these demands. You're like, you forget this is still an independent label, right?
Yeah, and also, I mean, some of these artists have had like one or two releases, and I mean, you know, for even them to be working with, I don't know, with a management company or why they have a management company, you know, I just see these companies as like, they're just vultures, you know?
So, yeah, it's a shame.
Yeah.
A little bit ago, I brought up piracy, or I just brought it up,
yeah.
but like, do you as a label, do you still feel much of it where like you notice like, okay, we're not moving what we're doing, but it seems like the record's a lot more popular than the sales, I believe? Or
it's good. Yeah, I mean, I to be honest, I don't know. We used to use all these things. There was these platforms you could use,
the watermarking stuff.
Yeah, yeah, but that. I don't think anyone uses them anymore, because I mean, our main revenue is Spotify. So, and that's because the label has been running for almost 18 years. So it's the catalog is big enough where the passive revenue is flowing. You know, it's coming from the mm-hmm. releases, coming from me or Nina or whoever it may be. It's constant income. So, and then of course, you know, it's, you know, there's the other things like Beatport and Bandcamp, but they only make up a fraction of the sales.
Yeah.
So, and then of course, I don't know. I mean, it's great if you see a record blow up, and that's why, I mean, it's great if a record is, if a DJ is playing your music, it's great if it's released rather than being unreleased, because if a crowd in an audience at a festival can Shazam your music, then they'll buy it.
Yeah.
If they don't know what it is, they'll move on. Yeah, so things like that. I can see that's why a lot of the A-list DJs will only play these. I'm talking maybe more about EDM or commercial DJs. They'll play music that they might play the odd unreleased song and they'll announce it or whatever.
Yeah.
But a lot of it is stuff that you can buy already. So, and yeah.
Or like some bootleg knockoff of like a Armin van Helden yeah. track or something, you know, the EDM
yeah, yeah.
gentrified version.
But, you know, it's important. I mean, I think it's because, you know, the thing is, the all of the traditional ways of consuming music that we grew up on, you know, going to the local record store on a Thursday, hanging out with DJs or buying magazines, reading charts in like, say, Mix Mag Update or wherever it may be, that's all gone. So finding ways of being able to let people know what the tracks are is things like Shazam work super well, you know?
Absolutely. You get a lot of demos for the label. I mean, it's pretty obvious, like bad music simply just doesn't get signed. But when you go through all these demos, is there like, do you notice any kind of common threads where you're like, oh man, this is where they've really fucked up? Like you see it all the time type stuff.
I don't know. I mean, I'm constantly listening to music and demos, but the problem is I'm getting sent demos from really, really a lot of them are really good artists, and I think there's less labels around at the moment, so a lot of people are jockeying to get their music released. And one of the problems is that the really prolific producers, obviously they're making so much music. So, and you can't release it all at once, and you can't release too much because it becomes boring. So, yeah, I'm really into this guy, Tal Fuzman, who's playing tonight at Watergate, and he makes so much music. I mean, we could release an EP from him every month. So, you know, so I'm being sent music from him. I'm being sent music from loads of people, you know, and it's a lot of it's really good.
Mm-hmm. I get what you're saying, though. It's tough. Like, I actually still have a ton of unreleased stuff. Things that I don't think they're relevant at the moment, but they will be just because they're a bit slower. So I just got to give it time. And then other things I want to come out. But like you said, you can't put out too much at a time or people get tired of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I've noticed when people send me records, they'll send me the 40-track demo. And maybe rarely, but maybe there is, let's say, 3 or 4 tracks that are worth signing for an EP. Then you have to realize, well, the other 30 tracks are still going to come out somewhere else and potentially tank the artist.
Yeah. You know? I mean, we work with this artist like Uncertain. And again, I mean, this guy's like a machine. It's like, I mean, he's releasing. So we have to work around his schedule with his releases. We're releasing an album from him at the end of the year. But he's got releases coming out every month. And I don't know whether at some point people are just going to go, I just can't have another Uncertain track in my collection, you know?
Everybody's going to have like different threshold with that stuff, you know what I mean?
But you mentioned techno and how it can be very functional. His sound, it works so well. It's a little bit like Mark Broom. So all of his stuff works, you know? It always works. It's like he's like the get out of jail guy, you know. Like I know if I have an uncertain folder in my record box, I could just go to that, you know.
It'll either pick it up or keep it going. Yeah. One of the two. As far as the label goes, I was thinking about it like after parties recently, and I know like people still have friends over for dinner and have some wine or whatever. I know that people still sit around on a couch and do drugs and stuff, all that. But like, I guess maybe because I'm older, but nobody seems to be talking about after parties anymore. But more importantly, after party music.
Right. Okay.
Like that kind of seems to have disappeared, right?
Yeah. I mean, I guess the problem, maybe one of the problems is that, you know, with the advent of be able to record video with phones. I mean, I can't imagine what that would have been like if when we had after parties, you know.
Absolutely.
Years ago. And but I don't know. I mean, there was this whole movement with Wolf and Lamb, and even like with Seth, with Vision Quest. It was, and I mean, that's a little bit maybe more of the commercial side.
Yeah.
And we could talk about like the more Perlon-esque sort of that mm-hmm. kind of vibe. But, you know, there was this kind of moment where it was the music seemed to be incredibly druggy, you know, and there was, you know, this sort of ketamine house and all this kind of thing. But I guess it's kind of, again, DJ culture, electronic music has become so commercial, and it's a career choice for people. You know, I think David Guetta has even talked about this, the fact that, you know, it's, you know, people, it's aspiring to be a DJ because kids can make money, and that's what they see. They see this as like, I'm going to make money, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And for sure, and that's why, again, it's maybe it's brought in a lot of the wrong people, a lot of very like narcissists and people that they just see this as like, I know what I want to do. I know how to perform. I know how to work social media. It's not about the music, and it's a million miles away from what you just mentioned with the after party sort of.
Absolutely. it's they're in it for themselves sort of thing. And those people, I definitely know some of them. They are, well, are they nice people? Some of them are, but like they definitely, they're like, this is the business mindset. Like I'm here to rinse it. I'm not really here to be part of the culture.
yeah, for sure. I mean, and don't think, you know, is there a place for us? I mean, I was listening to the other day to like Ricardo's remix of Shackleton.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is there a place for this kind of music in clubs anymore?
No.
Probably not.
Which is a shame. It's insane, that remix.
And but. I mean, I don't, you know, the thing is it's also the attention span of most people. I don't think that they... I mean, I still love making long tracks, and, you know, it works for me, and I'm still really into them, but I don't know whether the crowds will, you know, if I look at a lot of the videos that are online of a lot of DJs that are playing at the moment in maybe the top tier, they're just going through tracks, you know, it's flying through stuff, you know.
So. Whatever's new this week.
Yeah. But it's all about getting from A to B, from breakdown to breakdown to the next, you know, track that samples some 90s house thing that everyone can put their hands up to,
and then the snare roll, and then like the fucking the weight, and then boom, all this kind of bullshit, you know, like, I don't know, man. But what about DJing for you lately? Has it been, you've been feeling it, or what's up?
Yeah, it's been good. I'm not playing as much as I used to, but the gigs have been really good and was super interesting, and I've been traveling to some places where I'd never played at. So I've been to Asia quite a few times, and yeah, it's good. I mean, everyone sort of says the same thing, you know, it's the same story everywhere. There's a lot of sort of unrest about what's going on, and a lot of, you know, I don't know, it's people looking to blame, whether it's the promoter, the agents, or someone, you know. So I don't know. It seems to be the same everywhere, you know. And it's difficult because obviously I want to be as positive as I can, because I still really love what I do and I love the music, and I hear so much good new music, and I work with a lot of amazing artists. But, you know, there is definitely an unrest, or people seem to be really sort of dissatisfied with what's going on, you know.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think it's just felt everywhere because the politics are changing. The economy is kind of weird.
Yeah.
Like right now, everybody's feeling inflation. So it's it used to be you could go out in Berlin with like 30 euros in your pocket and it would go surprisingly far.
Or even less.
Yeah, exactly. And now like 30 bucks will get you a block down the street.
Yeah.
You know, and that's like if we get a couple of coffees and croissants after this or something, you know, it's crazy. So of course, people are going to be less interested in going out to party if they don't have the money.
Yeah, and I mean, as well, I've been talking about Berlin. I mean, I think that the electronic music in general is now such a global scene. So, you know, I think the focus has definitely moved away from Berlin, you know, so maybe the hype is over of techno tourism, or maybe the music lovers anyway. I mean, maybe they won't come to Berlin because they'll look at the lineup and go, this looks shit.
Yeah.
So, and, you know, I've got a lot of friends who don't go to certain clubs anymore that they used to love going to because of that. So, it is expensive.
It is. I mean, I don't know, like, I think for the techno side of things, especially when the more serious stuff, Berlin still has this allure to it. But for the most part, I think as far as the whole music industry goes for dance music, I don't think anybody gives a shit about Berlin.
No.
Like, it's not on the radar.
Yeah.
Like, before, you know, you had 20 years ago, it was like Bukashade and or whatever, all that kind of stuff. And now, like, none of that's really kicking from here. Nobody cares.
No.
In fact, I just saw some EDM person that was came up on a random YouTube thing on the TV yesterday, and they lived in Berlin. I'm like, I didn't even know they lived here. Like, how? Why would they be here?
Yeah.
It's just not that world at all.
Yeah, no, and it's that's the thing. Going back to what I said earlier, I mean, there's hardly any labels left here, and that's one of the reasons I moved here in the mid 2000s because Berlin was the epicenter of electronic music.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I kind of like the fact that it is global, it's regional, and there's so many great little pockets of or scenes happening everywhere. But it's a shame, and this is a negative aspect. It's a shame that I think that the voice of electronic music, I think, needs to change because at the moment the media outlets, I think, are failing drastically, and so the way that's the information's conveyed about certain things isn't right. So,
absolutely. I mean, it's there's also a lot of revisionist history going on right now about dance music.
Yeah, for sure. I think that, you know, if techno continues the way it's going, it will whitewash the history out of it. Will just Detroit is going to lose. I mean, it's sad, you know, in a way.
Absolutely.
I know there's some really good things happening in Detroit. There's amazing artists, and there are still some cool parties going on there. But I think in the grand scheme of things, you know, techno has now become something completely different. And I don't think there's, if probably in Spotify or wherever, the mainstream media, if they ever write about, some say Billboard or whatever, if they wrote about techno, they wouldn't mention Detroit.
No, definitely not.
They'd be Amelie Lenz or Charlotte DeWitt, you know, so.
Yeah. I don't know. I think about that a lot because it's like, on one hand, you get some people that just will blame the white people or the Europeans or whatever. And it's like, well, they just saw an opening for music that they liked. And then, of course, some of them bastardized it. You can't do anything about that. But then there's like, okay, well, what about there's a lot of Detroit supporters, but you never really hear about them. They're never really going out to the shows. You hear about how whatever Detroit legend had 40 people, okay, well, where are these people to support it? We were talking about DJing and gigs and stuff. That reminded me about something earlier. We were talking about back-to-back sets.
Okay.
And right now it seems like a lot of the festivals are having their back-to-back era where it's just like they randomly pick anybody to play that they think can fill, because it's all the same lineups, right? Yeah. They're like, but what if we have these two back to back instead of separate? And then none of it makes any sense, right? No. Like
I guess it's about numbers. It's just about having more names on the lineup. And if you look at, you look at a lot of these clubs, especially like Circa Loco in Ibiza, the set times, I mean, it's like 1.5 hours. I mean, it's just, or even when I saw Dixon on the lineup at Printworks, he played for an hour. I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, it's good for him.
Because
he's just getting paid a load of money and he's literally has to just arrive, literally play a few records and go home or play a few some tracks. But, you know, it's, you know, that kind of, I guess, this the storytelling, the art of DJing that Laurent Garnier is a, you know, big supporter of. I think that's becoming harder and harder to do, you know. And then,
totally.
And then on the other hand, I'm not a supporter either of this kind of these modern selectors because I don't feel like, you know, I think that they're also, it's not true storytelling either, just playing random old records, you know.
Yeah.
So.
No, I totally agree with that. And it's crazy because my Spotify is like the most random shit you've ever heard, almost jarringly so. But when it comes to a DJ set, I kind of like a little bit of context. And,
yeah.
You know? One topic that I'm curious about, and I think like you're a good person to chat about with it, is ageism and ostracism.
Right, okay.
Yeah. I mean, I think about this a lot lately as I inch into my next decade here. Just taking note of it all. But I came across a thread recently on Reddit that was talking about ageism and techno and whatnot. And I don't know. It was kind of alarming because there's a lot of people on there that are saying really ageist shit that they're not self-aware about. So the thread just kind of proves itself.
Right.
You're older than me. Have you ever experienced it much?
Yeah, of course. I mean, of course. I mean, when you're going to a club and you're playing to kids that are half your age, you of course you feel it. And but I don't know. I mean, I've been lucky enough to play in clubs in say like Italy, especially where the age range can be everything from say 17, 18 through to 50 or beyond. And same with Berlin, or if you go to Berghain. And I mean, with ageism, I mean, you've got to look at someone like Boris. I mean, Boris is 62. And, you know, he's so busy and, you know, incredibly popular with young and old audiences. And he's such an amazing DJ that he can basically adapt to anything and play disco and house in Panorama Bar and then play this really fast stuff to the kids, you know. And I remember actually I think it was about 2010, we'd had a party at Panorama Bar, and then on Sunday or Saturday night, we went with Boris to a squat party in Berlin. And that's the first time I heard him play all this kind of like, really, I was like, you're into this. And he was playing all this and stuff like Night Slugs and all this. But it was quite like reminding me of going to like an acid techno free party in the 90s, you know? So, you know, with him, you know, he's an amazing success story. You know, someone, he went to Paradise Garage, you know, and he's been around the block, but he's able to, like I said, he's able to adapt, and you know, he looks great, and he's playing to the kids, you know.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, yeah, I think this culture is definitely more open to older people than most, I would say, but I think there's definitely like ageism and ostracism in the sense of when it comes to information online. Like, yeah. For example, you and I can sit here and talk shit about TikTok techno for the next half hour, and then maybe they're valid points, but then you have people that will sit there and argue like gatekeeping, which that's not even the correct word.
But, you know, I don't know. I mean, most of the people I know that my age or around the same age, I mean, you know, they're all still super young at heart and still really sort of knowledgeable with what's going on. But, you know, I think that... I don't know. There's a lot of what's great about this scene in some ways is that there's been the sort of rise of the heritage DJs.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of DJs like, you know, Ian Pooley's having a bit of a renaissance because the kids really like this skippy night. Some kids like this really skippy sort of 90s house vibe. So, and it's working for him. And that's great, you know, so, and it's great that these things can come around and, you know, then you've got like guys like Robert Hood, you know, Robert's still at the top of his game and, you know, he's making everything from the house stuff with his daughter, with the floor plan stuff or, you know, techno and everything. And he's just did this and then he can do jazz with like Femi Kuti. I don't know. And then you've got guys, again, you've got Francois Kevorkian, who's probably almost 70 maybe, and he's still DJing everywhere and super proactive streaming and, you know, waving the flag, you know? So, yeah, it's a tough one because I think that the other thing is as well is that and people, I think you've always got to remember that electronic music isn't new.
No.
It's not a new format. It's been around for like 40 years, so or even beyond with like Kraftwerk or this sort of like the German progressive electronic
stuff.
You
can go back way more. Yeah.
So, and it's been it's been changing and progressing, but it's essentially the same thing. So, it's not new. And so I think that's a problem in itself. And I think what everyone's talking about, a lot of people are talking about at the moment, is obviously the demise of bands.
Mm-hmm.
And that people are really now starting to feel that's basically over, which is a shame. But it's we're now moving into a new world where it's just driven by DJs, which is fucking shit.
I agree.
You know, because it's like, and I think that's why essentially, unless that's why you've now seen the advent of the performance DJs, because you've got a big stage and 20,000 people with this little figure behind a booth, it's not very entertaining.
No.
You know,
you need a show.
You need a show. And then I think with the bands, I mean, you know, of course, when I was younger, or when I first got into electronic music, which was in the 80s with electro and scratching and turntablism and stuff like that, you know, I didn't want to hear bands. So,
yeah,
you know, and then as you get older, you're like, oh, wow, that's good. And, you know, so it's kind of like, you know, we could see it coming, but it's pretty pretty bad in that respect.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I'm a huge fan of the band world or whatever, so it's kind of really highly disappointing to me. And I mean, I love DJ culture, but at the same time, there's a lot of feeling that's missing from it that comes from actual musical movements. You know, and like with DJ culture these days, you were talking about a lot of people that are still pushing their age, which is awesome, and able to perform. Most other types of music scenes, you don't really have that. Maybe jazz a little bit, you know, or I don't know.
Or rock.
Bluegrass or something like that. But, you know, the problem that I'm seeing is like there are also a bunch of, well, I mean, they're not that much older than me, but older guys, like let's say in, you know, 50-ish, something like that. And you can kind of tell they're just going through the motions.
For sure.
You know, and that I can see why people would start to get tired of their shit too. Last weekend I heard the Bells and Knights of the Jaguar within an hour. Like, come on.
You know? I mean, for sure. I mean, I've always been, I would never like to fall into that category where you're doing it. I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, maybe people just end up just doing it for the money and doing it for all the wrong reasons. That sucks.
Yeah. And I mean, I think it's perfectly okay to get exhausting too.
Yeah, for sure.
Or exhausted. Like I spoke to another person in another industry and they were doing this thing their whole life and it was something they genuinely enjoyed, but they told me they were actually looking to get out of it.
Yeah.
No real main reason. They're just like, I'm done. I've done this enough. In fact, this person is into diving. It was a dive master and teacher. Just like, I've been under the water so many goddamn times. I'm just over it. You know? I was like, actually that reminded me, like, you can be passionate about something and be like, this doesn't have to be forever.
Well, I mean, I think especially with what we do, or electronic music, or any kind of things involving the arts, I mean, it can be incredibly exhausting and taxing. And, you know, like, I mean, I can have sleepless nights when it comes to working with within this industry. So I can see why a lot of people would want to leave, or they see that they want to have an exit from it. I just wanted to mention about the ageism thing, because what's interesting as well is that there's a lot of now clubs for older people that's happening. Like this, like in the UK, you've got Alphos, which A Love from Outer Space, which was Sean Johnson and Andrew Weatherall's night. And of course, Sean Johnson's continued this party. And this is essentially for gravers. This is your like plus 40 crowd. And again, this is a thing that just wasn't around like 20 years ago. So now you've got festivals and raves and parties that are catering to an older audience that might have had kids. The kids have grown up and they want to go out again, which I think is also great.
Yeah.
And that shows that there's this shift, you know, from when I was growing up, or my parents' generation, it was very much, you know, you go out, maybe my parents went to jazz clubs or whatever when they were younger, then they have the kids and they the job and they stay at home, you know, that was it. Or they would go to the cinema or whatever. But, you know, the fact that you could now do this is incredible, you know. And then
absolutely.
And enjoy music that spans, like we said, from the last 40 years or beyond, you know.
Totally.
And they're doing, and it's been incredibly successful, you know.
I mean, I can only see stuff like that starting to become more popular.
Yeah.
Because it's like, just because you get a little older doesn't mean you've died or you have no interest in, like some people want to go out and like, oh, I'm 47. Yeah. I haven't taken a pill in seven years. Let's try it once or something. You know what I mean?
And it's the same with, I mean, there's a lot of similarities between skateboard culture and electronic music. And
big time.
And there's a huge movement now for older skateboarders, because of course skateboarding has been around forever. And just because you get old doesn't mean you can't skateboard, you know? So,
I
think that there's been a movement towards that. Whereas before, anyone over there, you know, where anyone who's 30 plus might have been, oh, I can't go to a skate park because I'm just going to look like an idiot.
Yeah.
You know, now there's tons of skaters who are older, you know? So
totally. I mean, you used to see that back in the day more with like posh things like downhill skiing. That was really popular for older people.
Right.
You know, because it was actually, it sounds like strange, but safer than some other things because you don't have to do much as long as you know how to slow down.
But maybe that's a little bit of a elitist thing as well, because I mean you need money to ski as well.
I guess I was saying like I saw it in that kind of world before, but now like it just shows that older people still like to have fun or
for sure.
To move around. And then you know you get down to us lowly peasants, so like we would just be happy to go to a club.
I mean my sister actually lives in the French Alps and she skis. I mean my sister's in her mid-50s and she's an amazing skier, but a lot of her friends are older and it's so cool going skiing with them, you know.
That's what I'm saying, you know. Like this can exist. People just have to do it. You know, I guess it's a lot easier to have fun when you probably got a little money in the back pocket, right?
For sure.
Let's see, what other questions did I have here? Okay, I got some internet questions I'd like to go through if you got a minute.
It wasn't me.
Yeah, it wasn't. Nothing too scandalous. Pretty easy, easy-ish ones. How do you write a 10 to 15 minute track that remains both stripped down and interesting?
Keep it boring, I think is the motto. You know, less is more. I mean, it's a... essentially a groove thing. Groove helps. I don't know. I mean, I used to record a lot of my music. Well, literally just press record. And then back when I was smoking weed and I would just tinker around. Probably the same. I mean, I'm sure Ricardo still works exactly the same way. Because when we released some of his remixes, they've sent us the pre-masters and they've just said, just cut it down to whatever you want. So, I mean, it's essentially up to the producer. But I mean, I think, again, like, I don't know. I mean, when it comes to things like making longer tracks, then it comes essentially down to looking for that perfect beat. So if you have that perfect rhythm, depending on how long the loop is, then you can just let it go, you know, and it stays interesting. And, you know, that's the same with house as it is with techno.
Absolutely, I agree.
Yeah.
One of the things that I remembered from our Radio Zahn studio sessions, was that 2 years ago now or three?
It was three.
Damn,
four.
Time flies. Anyway, one of the things that I noticed is like I kind of came in with like a basic sketch or idea and in the track, I had a bunch of turnarounds and fills like on the 32 or the 64 or whatever, or dropped a kick drum. And then you just sit down on the computer and be like, okay, we're going to delete that. We'll keep the kick there. Basically just remove all of the things I did. And honestly, it was better because it was just dumber.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like your ear like would fixate on the groove versus all these changes and shit.
That's something I'm definitely, you know, going back to what we were talking about earlier about the making music, especially in the late 2000s. I mean, you've got to, having that mindset, and if you listen to a lot of like dub reggae, or if you listen to like Basic Channel or Rhythm and Sound, I've been listening to a lot of the studio stuff.
Yeah.
What's the producer?
Was it Studio One or something?
Yeah, the guy from Compact. Can't think of his name, but that is a really, that all those tracks still sound amazing, that Studio One stuff. And it's Wolfgang Voigt. And
I was thinking of Reinhardt or something, but no, Wolfgang.
So I've been revisiting his sound. And it takes a lot of, I wouldn't say it's like a mixture of courage and also just determination, just to not put stuff in.
Man.
And, you know, and the end result is maybe something that's actually better.
Yeah.
You know? And because, especially if you're playing music in a club, you can always take out a kick.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't need to, or you can add a feel, you know, these days with modern mixers. So
true.
You know, so less is more. Yeah.
And one of the other things that I found interesting, or I guess you could say even refreshing, is a lot of times when I do collaborations, particularly with techno people, they kind of freeze up and they don't know what to put in. They don't have any ideas. They hit random until they land on something. And there's nothing wrong with that.
No.
That's fun. But you can kind of tell they show up to the session with no ideas, or they're not hearing anything in their head.
Yeah.
When I sit down with you, you'd be like, I'm hearing a shaker right here on this beat, or we need like this kind of pad that goes there. Yeah. Like, you're very specific, and then you make it happen.
Yeah.
Not just like throw shit in the blender.
Yeah. You know? I mean, another aspect, I think, of the way that I work, that I'm quite good at letting things go as well, and kind of reaching a point where I'm like, okay, that's enough. Like, this is it. We're going to go with this. I'm going to arrange it. I'm more, you know, one of the hardest aspects I have of making music is actually the mixing. It's something I'm still battling with, even more so now because I'm just working with headphones at home. And, you know, for me, it's like, it's not how you make it, it's how it sounds in the end.
Yeah.
The end result is the most important thing, you know, not what you made it on or how you made it. It's the end result, you know, the sonics of it. And that's why some obviously very minimal music sounds so maximal, because it's so well produced, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I, you know, when I brought it at the same time, when I went into the sessions with you, I would bring like my UAD shit and all this and these plugins. And it worked, whatever. But then you would contribute and you'd be like, just stock Ableton shit. Yeah. And it sounded better.
Yeah.
And you're like, well, because it's the sound. It's what I'm the source that I'm using.
Yeah.
The rest
I mean,
of
I'm sure this is the thing. I mean, I'm sure with the Ableton, I mean, I try to use as little plugins as possible. But I mean, I'm sure Robert Henk's no idiot. I mean, the stuff that they make for Ableton is amazing. You know, why shouldn't it be? So I don't think... I think you can just look inside the box, you know?
Yeah. And it's all about how you put that shit together.
Yeah, for sure.
Which, you know, obviously you've got an ear for. So I guess for anybody listening, you don't have to look far. You just got to pay attention.
Yeah.
Another question. Are you worried about the underground techno scene?
There is none. I mean, yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, that's why we have the label RSPX, and I try and support as many artists as what I can, and I'm always looking for new artists, and I'm just keeping an eye on what's going on. But it's kind of really it's tough out there, and without going into it, because we could speak for hours and hours, you know, it's like, I just hope that things balance out a little bit, and that that maybe the live sector, I think that with regards to recorded music, I think underground techno is it's okay, because there's some great people making music, and it's kind of, it's not that, it's, I wouldn't say it's thriving, but it's existing.
There's people doing cool shit.
Yeah, yeah. And there's some brilliant artists out there, you know, making great music. But when it comes to the live aspect, that's something that I just think there's a lot of work to be done.
Yeah, I agree.
And I'm not a promoter.
Yeah, and I can tell you as one, I don't really know what to tell you. But there's another follow-up question actually from somebody else. They're like, where do you see it heading then?
That's a really good question. And I was lucky enough to go to IMS this year, the International Music Summit in Ibiza, and stay there for a week. Listening to a lot of panels, you know, there was keynote speakers from Juan Atkins to Simon Dunmore from Defected, and it was also all kinds of panels, right? And a lot of it was to do with fandom and things like Afro House and whatever. But I think no one's really addressing where it's going. And I think that that's a really interesting factor of electronic music, because I think no one really knows, you know, where we'll be in 5 years with it, you know? So... And, you know, and I don't know, I think that the media might even be ignoring it, because, you know, there's a lot of changes that are happening, probably totally due to still the pandemic, mm-hmm. and we're feeling the effects of the pandemic. And there was this honeymoon period after the pandemic. There was even during the pandemic, you know, the sale of sale of music equipment, hardware went up, and then now everyone's trying to sell their stuff, you know, and and then with the live scene, it's going down. And so I don't think anyone knows. Musically, I just hope it just gets better, you know, and I hope that the more people can pull together. I always feel that the best things happen when the worst things are happening, because people become really just annoyed. I mean, I think when I started the Radio Slave Project, I started it because I was pissed off with what was happening. I hated all the remixes that were coming out. It was just after this, you know, Super Club boom at the end of the 90s, and I was just really sort of, I fell out of love with what was happening, and that drove me forward. So I think, you know, maybe that's going to happen with electronic music, and maybe it is going to go more underground, you know, so we'll see.
Yeah, it's hard to say. And I mean, then you have other hot topics like AI. Who knows where it's going to go in the next 3-4 years?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure everyone's using AI. I mean, I'm using it with samples, stem separation and stuff like that. I've got a lot of friends who are using it. And I'm sure with electronic music, I think it's going to be super interesting, you know, when you can just type in, I want to make a song that sounds like Jeff Mills.
We did that on an episode.
Oh, really?
There's the last Matrix Man episode from a couple months ago. We were making shit. I think we were like trying to make maybe a Mills song and then a Matrix Man or something like that. We did it live. I typed it in on the computer and we Bluetoothed it in, and it was like pretty impressive.
Okay. And which one were you using? Which software?
I got like 25 people asking me after that. It was UDO, UDIO. I don't know if that one's still around. I know there's one called Suno that's around, but I think UDO is better.
Yeah. I think that with the UDO, I've listened to some songs. I mean, it's more song-based stuff with the singers.
All of it,
and
yeah.
And some of it's, I mean, it's great. And I mean, for a lot of people, this is the thing. And again, I mean, a lot of people I know that make music, they're quite introverted. I was incredibly introverted and shy when I was younger. I was really nervous when I used to DJ, you know, being in front of people, you know, I just wanted to be at home making music or doing whatever. And then I started enjoying playing, and I kind of learned to be able to deal with it. So being on a stage and being a clown doesn't suit everyone, you know? Yeah. So I think it's going to be interesting whether people can create avatars of themselves and hide behind these and make music. That's going to be interesting with AI.
Interesting.
You know? Because, you know, having another personality, you know, that's going to be, I think you're going to get some interesting artists coming out, you know?
For sure. I'm curious to see where it goes, because it's either going to be wildly interesting or it's going to wipe us all out. And that's okay, because most musicians are annoying. So.
Yeah, true.
When do you have that first spark where a track really starts to come together? Is that in concept or in production?
So a lot of the music that I'm making starts off as an idea, and I tend to write it down. So I have like notes on my laptop or at home. And where it could be either a word or a phrase or something, or it could be just I could have heard something. I'm thinking, I want to make something like this. But I don't know. I'm usually pretty quick with stuff. And I don't know. I've had those moments where I've got really stuck with tracks, and I've probably got tons and tons of like unfinished pieces of music, but then I'll just let it go.
Yeah,
I'll just like forget about it, you know.
Yeah.
And actually recently I found loads and loads of tracks I couldn't even remember that I made.
I had that a couple days ago. I'm like, fuck.
Yeah. No, I found these projects and I'm like, I don't even remember recording this, which is
anything
crazy.
Anything good?
Yeah, good. Nice. But I just don't remember.
Yeah,
which is really
it.
Odd, you know, and I'm, you know, so.
Right on. Another question is here. Musically, what impresses you the most? I'm assuming he means like genre. It wasn't really clear, but or maybe just pick something that you need in a song to get you excited or interested?
What, in a song that I've made or a song?
I guess it just wasn't like what really excites you about music the most, like whatever the genre, is it the idea or the groove or?
Yeah, I mean, I guess when I was younger, it was all about beats. And, you know, when I first started DJing, you know, I was buying two copies of every Strictly Rhythm record so that I could make them longer. You know, I was really lucky and fortunate enough to hear guys like, Larry Levan play at the Ministry of Sound. That's the first time I really heard someone play a track for like 30 minutes.
Oh, wow. So you got to hear Larry play
that? Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, he was playing on Friday nights at Ministry of Sound for the first, I think it was 6 months maybe. So it was amazing. It really, really, it just, he would play things like CC's Penniston Finally, but he would start off with a dub and then he would play the beats and then he would play the vocal and then he would go back to the instrumental. And then by the second time, people would start cheering, you know, so he was breaking records and stuff like that.
Yeah.
But musically, I don't know. I mean, I guess I get probably inspired, or I like listening to older music, you know, stuff. Mm-hmm. But it depends. I mean, I'm doing this radio show for this digital platform called Rover. It's ROVR. And I've got a show called Otok Life, which Otok means island in Croatian. And for this show, Joel Martin's on this show, Kurt DiGiorgio, Trevor Jackson. They all have shows on this platform. And so for this, I'm only playing ambient music or kind of like island inspired.
Balearic vibes.
Yeah, more, yeah. And so with this, I'm finding so much new music, like this band Loose Leaf. There's so many great ambient artists. And I'm really I'm enjoying doing this because it's great to listen to. And what's his name as well? Lars. I can't remember. There's loads of artists, but yeah, I'm enjoying listening to this stuff. But as I said to you before, I mean, for me, I like to, if I want to escape, if I want some escapism, sort of me time, rather than maybe listening to music, I'll just make music.
Yeah, that's where I'm at too.
So, and that's it.
Okay, so if someone's also making music, they want to know what is the best way to send that music to DJs, because Insta doesn't seem to work well. I can confirm that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, usually it's through friends of a friend, stuff like that. I mean, I get so many messages and I'll try and check them all and try and listen to the stuff. And yeah, it depends. I mean, I would say Instagram is still good. It's a good way to reach out to anyone. It's actually a really amazing way, even for me, to reach out to my heroes, musical heroes. It's probably the best way to do it. And or if SoundCloud comments, stuff like that, maybe going to read it.
Interesting, yeah.
Stuff like that.
I think you just got to get in where you fit in. Go to the party.
Yeah.
Meet these people out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah, you know,
for sure. One of the last internet questions, will we ever see a limited return of DJs and beers? And what about Trainwrecks meets DJs and beers?
That's good. We could do that. Yeah. So with DJs and beers, we're constantly talking about it. Obviously, it's we're trying to actually do a physical version where we'll all meet. We talked about doing it ADE, but I don't think it's going to happen. It might happen next year. Obviously everyone's just got super busy again. I mean, you know, Ali's just constantly on the road, and same with Chris. Mo's in LA doing this, his vinyl manufacturing thing, and touring, and David's super busy as well. So we're all busy, but it was fun. I mean, it was really, really, that was a good thing to do during the pandemic, but it became also, it was, you know, as you know, with doing anything, it's can become quite taxing and you know,
yeah, man,
doing it every week.
I'm asking the same fucking questions every week on the show. Is there's only so much you can talk about, yeah. You know, I mean, it's always fun to hang out with people and shoot the shit, but I think there's a time and a place where you're like, I need to pull the plug for a while, you know? I want to end on hopefully a couple good questions. I think they're always pretty fun. Everyone loves a nice disaster story. Like, what was, can you think of like a great bad party story, or like your least successful?
Okay, there's one that springs to mind in particular. And so basically I was in Melbourne for the Red Bull Music Academy. So this was 2007 or 8, I can't remember. Nina was there. She was a student. That's how I met her. And I played at this club, this huge club, and I can't remember the name, but it was in Melbourne. And I was playing vinyl then, and I played mouth to mouth, and I got taken off the decks.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
For mouth to mouth.
Yeah, I got paid, but I got paid a load of money, and they just didn't like me.
Wow.
It was like a commercial club. So, and I was fuming, I think, back at the, you know, at the time.
I would be throwing shit.
Yeah. But then I was like, just totally cool with it, you know?
Yeah. I mean, these days, someone kicked me off and be like, I got paid. I'm going to bed. Thanks. Yeah. Goodbye.
Yeah. I mean, that's those things can happen. I mean, stuff like that. But it hasn't happened to me, I don't think, since I've been taken off. Actually, I also did a party with Mark Ronson. Mm-hmm. I did the opening.
The producer.
So this was 2005. I got invited to do the opening of the Louis Vuitton store in Shanghai. And it's a huge party, like, you know, loads and loads of guests. And so they had these huge urns that they'd made that you'd climb up inside and had DJ booths. So I was in one and Mark was in the other. And the idea was to flip between.
Oh, okay.
And that was another one where I got taken off. I was playing all kinds of music, but I was like, okay, cool, I'm off.
Yeah. Damn. I mean, I guess that was also at a point though where maybe they thought you were going to do like maybe something like the Kylie Minogue remix type stuff.
I mean, this was before. Yeah, I just don't know. I mean, we paid a load of money, but again, I was playing for people that. It was Louis Vuitton, so they had no idea, you know.
Yeah, they didn't give a shit. They were just there for the free booze.
And I think at the time, Mark, this was pre him doing the stuff, the producing stuff. He was P. Diddy's DJ back then, you know.
Mm-hmm. That's crazy how times change.
Yeah.
P. Diddy, that dude's in a lot of trouble these days.
Definitely. He's another one. I mean, I've DJed at his house as well. That was funny.
Oh, really?
Yeah, on Star Island. That was pretty hilarious.
Oh, so you're at his place on Star Island. Shit,
don't tell anyone.
Well, it's too late now. But I mean, like, was it one of those things where you really felt like you were just a hired hand, or did it?
He was really into it. I mean, he was obviously into it from the look on his face, and I think that was where that, you know, there was that infamous video of Seth with the bats. I think that's at that party.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Funny.
Those were definitely, I mean, again, talking about the difference between now and then. I mean, I think it was pretty hedonistic and pretty wild back then. I'm sure it is at some parties these days.
Yeah.
But it was definitely different because there was no phones. I think there we might have even had to give up the phones. I can't remember.
At P. Diddy's place, considering what he's doing these days, I'm sure you gave up the phones.
Yeah. But it was definitely wild back then.
And, you know, I mean, there was camera phones, but they were real shit, so we couldn't do much. But the other part of it was I think just also the consumption culture was different. You know, back then you had a lot of people doing like MDMA or K or something.
Yeah.
Now there's like a lot of G and speed, and like that's not really happy, lovey-dovey vibes or, you know, being silly. So,
yeah.
Crazy how time flies.
Yeah.
What was one or some of the worst jobs you've ever had?
Worst jobs I've ever had. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I was working at a health food shop in my early 20s. I mean, I went through some, you know, I've been a DJ since I was like since I was 21, 22, like working in nightclubs. But it hasn't always been, you know, like there's been some times where I've had to do other things, you know.
Of course.
I was in the late 90s, I lost my job. I was working for, it was actually maybe just before the Radio Slave thing. I lost my job. I was working for an events company in London. It was a full-time job and we were doing parties at Fabric, at Home. We did a track mode party with Larry Heard and we did all kinds of parties. We booked Rome Anthony when he was still alive. I was there. I remember being with Thomas Bangalter at Fabric, you know, when Rome Anthony did a live show.
I still can't believe that dude was white.
Who's that?
Rome Anthony?
Was he?
I think so. I thought I saw a picture. I'm like, I thought he was black for sure. Really? Okay. Well, then I'm wrong.
I was going to say, so yeah, I lost my job and I ended up working for American Express and in Brighton, you know, doing customer service.
I was super black. Somebody lied to me. We'll cut that out. Go on.
So yeah, so basically I lost my job and ended up working. I was living in Brighton at the time and I ended up working at American Express, and it was funny because, and then the radio slave thing kicked in. And I was going and doing this job in the morning, working in like platinum card and corporate card services, and dealing with all these middle management people and everything, with all the bullshit. This was a time, I always remember, when they could start doing the screen scraping. So there was me sitting at my desk answering calls, looking at eBay, and then being called over. And they could you know, I'm saying, good morning, you're speaking to blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, I'm trawling through eBay, buying records and stuff. But, and then of course, then the remixing took off and I would be going into, we'd have these like meetings and they'd say, what did you do at the weekend? And I'd be like, oh, well, I was remixing Paul McCartney.
Which is crazy, right?
Yeah. So, but still I needed this, you know, day job just because I needed the money. I mean, I wasn't, back then, and I mean, it was so different. I mean, I had a manager for the remixing, but very few people had managers, you know, for especially in dance music, yeah, unless you were like a certain level, you know. It was especially, and also agents. And I mean, I can tell you this, when I was resident at Ministry of Sound, I think I was getting like 50 or 100 pounds maximum, something like that.
And no, there would
be
small.
And there'd be no, like dinner, or there'd be no like buyout for the taxis and all that shit. No,
I mean, I played for such shit fees for so long. You have to. Now a lot of people expect like they should get something right off the bat. Maybe they should, maybe they shouldn't. Who knows?
Well, I don't. But, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I certainly believe you should earn your stripes. And mm-hmm. I mean, to get a foot in the door, or to get even have a DJ gig. I mean, I used to travel in my record box. I'm sure you did, everywhere. Oh, yeah. Just on the off chance that I could play, you know, I had the opportunity, you know, and whether it was a house party or wherever, I'd always have my records and stuff like that. But, you know, monetizing it or expecting to get paid a proper decent fee was just like, that was just...
It was insane.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember the first time ever that somebody actually paid me $1,000 to go DJ, and I'm like, I thought it was just the biggest joke. I'm like, you're actually going to pay me that? I thought it was a one-time thing. Like, it would never happen again, because that's so absurd. Yeah. You know, I was used to like 200 or something, you know, and times change.
Yeah.
We're getting up there. It's we're about an hour and 45 into the show here. You got anything that you want to plug for this fall or winter here?
Well, I mean, by the time people hear this, we've already probably done our party, which is happening tonight at Watergate, which is our first records party at Watergate. So House of Records. And we've been doing records parties in Berlin since 2007. So it's a long time, having done so many at Panorama Bar, Berghain Canteen, Elsa, Zaklapper, probably some other places as well. Yeah. So doing that, and again, that's sort of something that we're investing a lot of time in too at the moment, is the event side of records. And you know, it's a great way to shout about the label, and so we're looking at partnering with clubs and trying to bring that to, you know, cities around the world, you know, make that as something that we can do on a regular basis. And no, apart from that, we've got just loads of music coming out.
Awesome. So you can always keep ahead on the records official channels. Yeah, yeah. Radio Slave Official, is that pretty much what it is as well? Okay. Any other tours coming up in the early fall here? Or?
Well, actually, this is, I'm actually about to get my American visa. So I actually haven't been to the States since March 2020. I think the last place I played was at Cross Festival in San Diego. And I think at the time, I think that might have been when there was a cruise ship stuck out of the main harbor full of people with COVID.
Oh shit, okay.
Yeah, and that was the, and literally I got back from the States that week, and that's, I remember Chris coming, Chris Lieben came to my house, cause, and he was like, it's over, everything's going to stop, you know, and literally it did. And so I haven't been to the States since then. It's took a while, taken a while to sort out the visa. So I'm going to be doing quite a lot of touring in America in October and November and possibly in December. So,
wow.
Yeah. Look, I've got a lot of places to go to. I mean, I just haven't been there, so I'm super excited, actually.
There's cool shit going on in America right now. I mean, it's a little hit or miss, but like when it's fun, it's really fun lately. Yeah. So that's cool. Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on the show.
No, thank
Always
you.
Always good to see you.
Yeah.
And enjoy tonight.
Thank you.
Yeah, have Cheers. A good one.